earning their trust and getting them to open up about their plans. I interviewed a whole range of Al-Qaeda members with different ideologies to get an idea of how the war between the terrorists and Washington would develop in the future, he wrote. In a little-noticed 2005 book, Al-Zarqawi, The Second Generation of Al-Qaeda, which was published in Arabic, Hussein revealed the terrorist group's 20-year plan, which, in their own words, has seven different phases. Phase 1, the Muslim Awakening, 2000 to 2003. Beginning with 9/11 and ending with the U.S. invasion of Iraq, this phase was aimed at provoking the West. The first phase was judged by the strategists and masterminds behind Al-Qaeda as very successful, Hussein reported. The battlefield was opened up and the Americans and their allies became a closer and easier target. Phase 2, Opening Eyes, 2003 to 2006. The second phase was the mainstreaming of Al-Qaeda's cause within the Muslim world. The terrorist organization becomes a broader ideological movement, the vanguard for a political effort to reawaken millions of followers of Islam and return them to the foundations of their faith. This phase is primarily accomplished through propaganda broadcasts around the world and with tactical battlefield victories in Afghanistan and Iraq. Iraq in particular, which the United States invades in March 2003, is to become the center for all global operations, with an army set up there and bases established in other Arabic states. More and more Muslims are recruited to join the cause, and other like-minded terrorist organizations pledge bayat, or allegiance to bin Laden. Phase 3, Arising and Standing Up, 2007 to 2010. The fight expands from Iraq, and the assault begins on neighboring Syria, Jordan, Turkey, and Israel, where secular and anti-Islamic governments reign. Special priority would be placed on Syria, Hussein reported. Phase 4, Collapse, 2010 to 2013. Revolution begins to sweep the Middle East, and the infidel governments, such as Egypt's, begin to fall. These hated regimes are to be swept away by popular revolts. The creeping loss of the regime's power will lead to a steady growth in strength within Al-Qaeda, wrote Hussein. Attacks continue against the United States, with a special emphasis on cyber attacks to target America's economic might. Phase 5, Caliphate, 2013 to 2016. An Islamic State will be formally declared. The West will begin to lose much of its will to fight, allowing Al-Qaeda and its allies to recreate the Caliphate for the first time in 9 decades. Because Western resistance is so limited, the caliphate will grow over time in strength and territory. It is the first step in replacing the world order of sovereign nation states with a new world order, divided between the caliphate and the Muslim community of believers, Dar al-Islam, and the unbelievers, Dar al-Harb, or House of War. Phase 6, Total Confrontation, 2016 to 2019. The shocking rise of the caliphate will instigate the fight between the believers and non-believers. This, in the terrorists' view, will be the West's final dying breath to confront the growing Islamic armies. The West will muster all of its technological capabilities and advantages to destroy the caliphate and the many thousands of Muslims who have volunteered to fight on its behalf. Phase 7, Definitive Victory, 2020. The caliphate will triumph over the West. The stunning victory will convince the many millions of Muslims who had remained on the fence to join the Islamic State. 1.5 billion Muslims strong, the caliphate will be the world's lone superpower. Does this all sound absurd? Well, consider that as of 2015, a decade after the plan was first published by Hussein, the first 5 phases have been right on schedule. Phases 1 and 2, the invasion of Iraq, and the management of savagery. Al-Qaeda believes that they successfully induced America to invade Iraq in 2003, an event they used to their full advantage to sap the morale, resources, and lives of the most powerful nation of the world. The Iraq War also conveniently removed the major counterweight to the Islamic Republic of Iran, Saddam Hussein. Toppling Saddam set off a wave of events and instability that gave rise to the caliphate, which currently calls the western half of Iraq home. Al-Qaeda's leadership has long believed that the road to a caliphate runs through Baghdad. In 2003, Iraq became a training ground for al-Qaeda and ground zero for the newly forming alliances between the leadership of the terrorist group in Pakistan, Osama bin Laden and his deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri, and a particularly psychopathic recruit, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who had traveled to Baghdad after fleeing U.S. bombing in Afghanistan in 2001. Zarqawi founded al-Qaeda in Iraq and began a merciless campaign against U.S. forces and America's Iraqi Shia allies. In 2005, Zawahiri wrote a letter to Zarqawi with his marching orders. "The establishment of a caliphate in the manner of the Prophet will not be achieved except through jihad against the apostate rulers and their removal." To do so, they believed, would require the unleashing of brutality not witnessed since the days of the Third Reich. In 2004, a book titled "The Management of Savagery, the Most Critical Stage Through Which the Ummah Will Pass" by Abu Bakr Naji began circulating in jihadist circles. Western counterterrorism experts dubbed it the Mein Kampf of jihad, and for good reason. Naji served as the terrorist's leading intellectual and moral compass. The Management of Savagery advised al-Qaeda and its fellow travelers to create as much savagery and murder as possible so that the world descends into chaos. To Naji's thinking, chaos would ensure that the colonial borders created by the Sykes-Picot Agreement would disappear as governments prove unable to control their populations and impose their secular ungodly laws. Rebellions would take place across the Muslim world, and no Western power, least of all the United States, would be able to do a thing about it. With continuous attacks bruising and bloodying the world's superpower, America would lose its aura of invincibility. In the chaos, Naji argued, a new caliphate could emerge. If we succeed in the management of this savagery, that stage, by the permission of God, will be a bridge to the Islamic State which has been awaited since the fall of the caliphate, Naji wrote, a decade before the Islamic State officially was declared. If we fail, we seek refuge with God from that. It does not mean an end of the matter. Rather, this failure will lead to an increase in savagery. Naji drew on the example of the first two caliphs after the death of Muhammad to justify his brutal tactics. They burned people with fire, even though it is odious, because they knew the effect of rough violence in times of need. The massacre of other Muslims was commonplace in the years after Muhammad's death. Dragging the masses into the battle requires more actions which will inflame opposition and which will make people enter into the battle willing or unwilling. We must make this battle very violent, such that death is a heartbeat away. In fact, according to Naji, there is mercy in all of this barbarism. Some may be surprised when we say that the religious practice of jihad, despite the blood, corpses, and limbs which encompass it, and the killing and fighting which its practice entails, is among the most blessed acts of worship for the servants. Jihad is the most merciful of the methods for all created things and the most sparing of the spilling of blood. The shocking violence of beheadings, crucifixions, and murder of women and children is anything but senseless. It is purposeful, necessary to strike fear and create a lasting psychological effect that the caliphate is inevitable and its followers are willing to stop at nothing to impose it. Zarqawi implemented Naji's barbaric vision with ruthless efficiency. Before he became the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, al-Qaeda as a whole was responsible for the deaths of around 3,200 people worldwide. In just 2 years, Zarqawi's group was responsible for the deaths of twice that many people in Iraq alone. Iraq is also where al-Qaeda transitioned from a small terrorist group into a broader social movement. With Zarqawi and his senior lieutenant Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who would go on to become the first caliph, the beginnings of what would become ISIS had formed. Phases 1 and 2 were successfully completed right on schedule. Phases 3 and 4, Arab Spring, Arab Winter, and the Syrian Civil War. As Zarqawi and his followers forced Iraq into the depths of chaos, al-Qaeda's strategy to stoke a global civil war that could lay the foundations for a new caliphate began to take shape. One ripe target was Egypt. ever since the more extreme offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood assassinated Egypt's moderate president, Anwar Sadat, in 1981, they have kept their eye on the prize. The final takeover of the most populous and culturally significant nation in the Arab world. It took nearly a quarter of a century, but in 2011, unrest led to the toppling of Egypt's dictator, Hosni Mubarak. He was thrown into prison, and the Muslim Brotherhood swept into power. This was the culmination of what became known here in the West as the Arab Spring. In one telling of it, the Arab Spring began when a Tunisian fruit vendor set himself ablaze to protest the lack of individual rights in his country. This allegedly led to a sweeping movement where some, but not all, protesters demanded democracy and political freedom. At the time, Barack Obama and neoconservatives alike heralded the triumph of freedom. What followed, they wanted us to believe, would be a mass democratic movement across the Middle East, the very embodiment of the human aspiration to be free. That, of course, is not at all what happened. And this rosy view was not in any way representative of what was going on at the time. What the Arab Spring was really about was the ascendance of Islamic supremacy, with Islamist parties such as the Muslim Brotherhood using the euphoria to take power. Calls for democracy are just the train we board to reach our destination, according to Turkey's Islamist strongman Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Democracy, at least where it's been tried in Iraq, the Gaza Strip, and Egypt, has led only to the election of undemocratic strongmen and Islamist parties that see democracy as a temporary step toward Sharia. The truth is that freedom has a different meaning for most Muslims in the Middle East than it does for the rest of us. In the Islamic tradition, freedom, or hurriya, is freedom from man-made laws. We want to free all people from being slaves of men and make them slaves to Allah, explained Abu Abdullah, one of the leaders of Hizba ut-Tahrir, an Islamist political party with thousands of members worldwide. Democracy in the Islamic world, simply put, isn't really democracy. It's Islamic supremacy led by rulers, not representatives. Leaders of Islamic democracies are there to interpret and execute God's law. As Middle Eastern historian Bernard Lewis wrote in 1954, "The political history of Islam is one of almost unrelieved autocracy. It was authoritarian, often arbitrary, sometimes tyrannical. There are no parliaments or representative assemblies of any kind, no councils or communes, no chambers of nobility or states, no municipalities in the history of Islam. Nothing but sovereign power, to which the subject owed complete and unwavering obedience as a religious duty imposed by the holy law." Islamism cannot coexist with freedom in any meaningful way. Votes may be held, and constitutions may be written, but societies that insist on a truly Islamic foundation for their political authority do not allow for straying from what's demanded by the Quran and Hadith. As Egypt's leading Muslim Brotherhood scholar, Sheikh Qaradawi, said, "Legislation belongs to God, and we only fill in the blanks." Put simply, there is the truth as revealed by Islam, and there is everything else. God's truth necessarily suppresses free expression and free will, and gives way to a totalitarianism in which no democracy deserving of the name can function in a meaningful way. It's little wonder why the mass democratic uprisings of the Arab Spring withered on the vine and now lie dormant in the bitter winter that has swept from North Africa to the Persian Gulf. Al-Qaeda and its Sunni Islamist allies not only toppled the most important secular government in the region of Egypt, they also successfully provoked a civil war in Syria against dictator Bashar al-Assad, who belongs to the Alawite, non-Sunni majority. Syria, as explained earlier, is home to Dabiq, a place viewed by many Muslims as the location of the final battle between the forces of Islam and the infidels. Just as important, it is the doorstep to toppling Jordan and Israel. One good reason why there was a special focus on Syria in Phase 3 of Al-Qaeda's 20-year plan. In 2011, Assad's opposition was a hodgepodge that included some secularists and reformers who were quickly outgunned, killed, or sent into exile. Those who remained were the hardcore Salafist Islamist holdouts and Al-Qaeda affiliates, many of whom were combat-hardened veterans from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. These groups were themselves divided, with various smaller groups, such as Jabhat al-Nusra and the Yarmouk Brigade, all vying for influence. The Obama administration saw little danger in the growing menace. In September 2013, they came within days of providing al-Qaeda with the world's most advanced air force, before public and congressional outcry forced them to reverse course. The Syrian civil war had created a vacuum in which ISIS could recruit, train, and kill almost at will. All they needed next was a government. Phases 3 and 4 were complete, right on schedule. Phase 5, the black flag of the caliphate and the merging of al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. 5 months after President Obama referred to ISIS as the JV team, they established the Islamic State and a caliphate, a terrorist state in the heart of the Middle East. Its capital is al-Raqqa in eastern Syria. Week by week, the Islamic State has taken more and more territory with impunity. We are now in the midst of witnessing the merging of al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. As we've already seen, before there was an Islamic State, there was ISIS, and before there was ISIS, there was al-Qaeda's Iraq branch. The Obama administration would prefer to keep al-Qaeda separate from the Islamic State so they can continue to boast about how they have decimated the terrorist group that struck us on 9/11. They would have us believe that core al-Qaeda, a narrow and misleading term meant to limit the group to its current leader, the aging Ayman al-Zawahiri and his immediate inner circle in Pakistan, has little impact anymore. But this cheerful appraisal of the situation misses the point that al-Qaeda has evolved from a terrorist organization to an ideological movement to which ISIS and dozens of other jihadi groups pledge allegiance. As left-wing journalist Patrick Coburn, who has spent more time in Syria studying the rise of ISIS than any other Western journalist, wrote, "Al-Qaeda's name became primarily a rallying cry, a set of Islamic beliefs, centering on the creation of an Islamic state, the imposition of Sharia, a return to Islamic customs, the subjugation of women, and the waging of holy war against other Muslims, notably the Shia, who are considered heretics worthy of death. It has always been in the interest of the U.S. and other governments that al-Qaeda be viewed as having a command and control structure like a mini-Pentagon or like the Mafia in America. This is a comforting image for the public because organized groups, however demonic, can be tracked down and eliminated through imprisonment or death. More alarming is the reality of a movement whose adherents are self-recruited and can spring up anywhere." In 2014, with the declaration of the Islamic State, al-Qaeda ideology and terrorist tactics went mainstream and were adopted by a quasi-government that controls and governs territory. Not coincidentally, this was exactly the plan al-Qaeda had outlined a decade earlier when it predicted that other terrorist groups would adopt its goals and that by 2013, a new Islamic government would form a caliphate under its banner. Phase 5 was also successfully completed right on schedule. Phase 6, total confrontation. The Islamists believe we are currently in the sixth phase of their plan right now, a global conflict with the West that will bring about our last dying gasps while also expunging those Muslims who deny fundamentalist Islamic authority. Al-Qaeda and ISIS have targeted for death thousands of Shia in Iraq, whom the Islamic State calls Rafida, a slur from early Islam that means rejectors or people who deny legitimate Islamic authority. ISIS, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and other Sunni nations of the Gulf are also aligning against the Shia in Iran. Iran, meanwhile, is fighting back on behalf of the region's Shia population, escalating the civil war within Islam to bloody proportions not seen in more than a millennium. Iran has created a vassal state with the neighboring government in Iraq, with its Shia soldiers and militias becoming the only effective fighting force against the Islamic State. Iran has funded rebellions of Shia minorities in Bahrain and Yemen to foment instability. Iran, in short, is trying to recreate the Persian Empire, which was defeated by the first armies of Islam in the 7th century and became part of the Umayyad Caliphate. While this vicious conflict within Islam is already well underway, few people in our government even seem to understand it. Sylvester Reyes, a Texas Democrat who was the incoming chairman of the House Intelligence Committee before Republicans reclaimed Congress, was asked whether al-Qaeda was Sunni or Shia. He didn't really know. "Predominantly probably Shiite," he responded. "And Hezbollah in Lebanon?" Hezbollah, why do you ask me these questions at 5 o'clock? He later offered an explanation. "Speaking only for myself, it's hard to keep things in perspective and in the categories." And yet perspective and categories are exactly what we need if we want to understand the war that is engulfing Islam and threatens to expand into a global war, annihilating Israel and posing a dire threat to America and the West. If there is a glimmer of hope in all of this bad news, it is that the Sunni and Shia extremists hate each other almost as much as they hate Israel and the West. They're already killing each other in droves across Iraq and in places like Yemen, where civil wars are breaking out. But here's the thing. While they kill each other with AK-47s, RPGs, and suicide bombs for now, each side is seeking to be the first to get its hands on the ultimate prize: nuclear weapons. This is a nightmare scenario, one that could literally bring about the end times in the form of a nuclear winter that engulfs the region and possibly the world. The U.S. government is not helping matters. Under the terms of a negotiated nuclear agreement with Iran, the United States will effectively bless Iran's nuclear program in return for a normalization of relations between the two countries. To counter Iran, Saudi Arabia then made the strategic decision to acquire off-the-shelf atomic weapons from Pakistan. Given the splintering sides between Team Shia and Team Sunni, it's not inconceivable that a nuclear Saudi Arabia could ally with the Islamic State. Both are ruled by extreme Salafist Sunni Muslims. The Islamic State is trying to persuade Sunni Muslims that they are the true protectors of Islam. And there are some signs that it's working. Ibrahim Hamidi, a journalist and leading analyst of the Islamic State, told the New York Times that the group is hijacking legitimate demands, meaning they are filling a political and social vacuum in the areas they conquer. Now, Hamidi explained, with the sectarian polarization of the region under the skin of every single Sunni, there is a tiny Daesh. Daesh is the Arabic acronym for the Islamic State. In other words, even the many Muslims who object to the Islamic State's brutal tactics are beginning to sympathize with their goals. They've become so mainstream that there's even a slang word for the many people who are inclined to support ISIS: Dawush, an Arabic term that means cute little Daesh. The Islamic State and Iran are forcing the Islamic world into two camps, opposed to each other by virtue of a 1,300-year-old split, but united in their embrace of radical Islamism and totalitarian apocalyptic ideology. Increasingly, there is no room for moderates in the middle. Most people in the West are still blind to this, but if Phase 6 of the plan is executed as effectively and efficiently as the other five phases, they won't be blind for long. Part 2. 13 Deadly Lies. If you look for truth, you may find comfort in the end. If you look for comfort, you will not get either comfort or truth. Only soft soap and wishful thinking to begin, and in the end, despair. C.S. Lewis. Introduction to Part 2. We haven't been honest with ourselves for a long time. We've allowed political correctness, fear, and simple ignorance to mask basic truths about Islam and the Quran. These truths need to be confronted in order to defend ourselves, our families, and our country. In other words, we need to stop lying to ourselves, and perhaps more important, we need to stop allowing ourselves to be lied to. We hear lies about Islam nearly every day, in nearly every place, in nearly every manner. They usually originate with elites in the media, in Washington, D.C., and Hollywood. In 2010, for example, National Public Radio aired a bizarre segment with the headline, "Is the Bible More Violent Than the Quran?" Spoiler alert, liberal NPR says yes. A few years later, noted Islam expert Ben Affleck took Bill Maher to task for attacking what Affleck called the officially codified doctrine of Islam. questioning the tenets of Islam Affleck claimed was gross and racist. The Architect of Lies. How did we get here? With their supremacist ideology, whether the form practiced by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and the Islamic State, or Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and the clerics of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Islamists know what they stand for. But do we? I'm not so sure anymore. America and the West are more timid than ever. Those of us who stand up for our most cherished values, freedom of expression, for example, are denounced as insensitive racists and pronounced guilty of hate speech. Government leaders and media types pile on, telling us that we are in no place to criticize other cultures and religions. It's a mentality that has infected the entire discussion, or lack thereof, surrounding Islam and terrorism. I want to introduce you to someone whom very few people outside of academic circles have ever heard of, yet who has had the most enduring impact on the way we talk and think about Islam in the Middle East. Perhaps no one is more responsible for imposing a straitjacket of political correctness on any discussion involving Islam than the late Edward Said. Said grew up in Jerusalem and Cairo in an affluent family. He came to America to study at an elite New England prep school and then went on to Princeton and Harvard, where he got his Ph.D. He eventually became a professor of literature at Columbia University, where in 1978 he published Orientalism, a book that forever changed the way academia, the mainstream media, and the West's elites thought about Islam in the Middle East. Said argued that the entire field of Middle Eastern history and studies in the West was an exercise in creating the perception of a different and inferior Oriental culture, so that it could be taken over by Western imperialists. He claimed that all Western scholarship on the Middle East and Islam was a form of racism, an intrinsically hostile pillar of imperialism. Any Westerner or non-Muslim who studied Islam or the Middle East, intentionally or not, developed an absolute and systematic difference between the West, which is rational, developed, humane, superior, and the Orient, which is aberrant, undeveloped, inferior. In other words, Said believed that if you're a person of European descent, then talking about the religion of 1.6 billion Muslims is inherently racist. Said's book created shockwaves in the academic world. It was soon translated into more than 36 languages and became deeply influential in most of the world's universities. In 2005, Edward Said's books were assigned as reading in at least 868 courses in American colleges and universities, counting only courses whose syllabi were available online. More than 40 books have been published about Said, and multiple universities offer whole courses about him. Said accused Western scholars of Eastern studies, particularly Middle Eastern studies, as conscious enablers of exploitation and subjugation. Linguists, historians, anthropologists, and archaeologists had all been willing instruments of colonialism and empire building. Western scholars had accomplished this evil work by defining the West in opposition to the other. In the case of Orientals, the other was someone to be feared or to be controlled. He claimed that literally everything a European or American said about the Orient made them a racist, an imperialist, and almost totally ethnocentric. He framed the Israeli-Palestinian struggle in terms of white European colonial oppression of poor, helpless, dark-skinned natives. Multiculturalism started out as a form of enhanced tolerance for cultural differences. Edward Said turned that into an instrument of intolerance, a system for classifying all kinds of comments about Middle Eastern religions, cultures, and societies as racist and forbidden. He taught a whole generation of students how to hurl accusations of hostility and racism when they disagree with someone. Our universities are teaching students how to use victimhood, grievance, and taking offense as tools of control. Students are being taught socially acceptable ways to censor each other, to control each other's speech, and to suppress beliefs they don't agree with. When a military unit is about to make a move or attack a target, they often start with suppression fire. They sweep everything in front of their attacking unit with artillery and machine gun rounds, forcing the enemy to duck for cover so their troops can advance. That's pretty much how Said's theories, his framing of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, and his cult of censorship all advance the Islamist cause and the terrorists who kill in Islam's name. As Islamists gain momentum, there are seemingly fewer and fewer people who are willing to stand and call the enemy by their name. Said's disciples and his fear-inducing rules for thinking about the world make those people duck for cover. When they do, the Islamist troops advance even further. It is about Islam. Think back on the last decade. How many times has the following scenario played out? There's been a horrific terrorist attack somewhere around the globe. Amid the initial confusion, several key facts become clear. The perpetrators were observant Muslims who recorded a video to alert the world they were engaged in jihad. The perpetrators' families and community proudly declare them shahids or martyrs. Before the day is out, talking heads in the media are showcasing a parade of PhDs and government officials, calmly telling the audience that this, in fact, had nothing to do with Islam. It's been the refrain since 2001, first from the Bush administration, then from Obama's. It could have been a plausible argument had there been one or two terrorist attacks rather than the 25,000 global incidents, according to a website that tracks terrorist activities around the world, we've endured. It could have fooled a lot more people in a time before TV news, the internet, and social media. But when we see the most graphic barbarism accompanied by constant calls for Sharia or Islamic law and justified by passages in the Quran and Hadith, it should become plainly obvious that we're being lied to. In fact, for the mainstream media, the only criterion for alternate theories about the cause of terrorism seems to be that they must have absolutely nothing to do with Islam. Instead, the causes cited usually include things like poverty, American foreign policy, and, of course, Israel. As we'll see, they've even tried to make global warming the explanation for why ISIS terrorists have undertaken a campaign of murder sweeping the Middle East. These people are clueless. But the rest of us don't have to be. The American people aren't stupid. Even in the face of unrelenting media assurances, bald-faced propaganda, and smug lies from the most powerful public officials, things are so utterly and obviously wrong that even a hypnotized and often distracted nation has a hard time believing them any longer. In this section of the book, we'll do what very few people seem to be willing to. We will take apart the lies we commonly hear about Islam. We will systematically dismantle the notion that terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda, rogue regimes like Iran, apocalyptic armies of ISIS, and their collective vision of a caliphate have nothing to do with Islam. Let me say it again. It is about Islam. This is not a book written for people looking to be easily offended. I won't be carefully parsing every word of every chapter to ensure that I am constantly using all the correct PC terminology. Anyone who has listened or watched me for a while knows my stance. People can choose good or evil, peace or violence. The faith of 1.6 billion people around the world is not inherently bad, but those who insist on a fundamentalist, outdated, supremacist reading of it are. This is the key distinction between Islam and Islamism, which is the totalitarian vision that knows no separation between religion and politics and is utterly incompatible with freedom and individual liberty. From the heartland of Syria to the government halls of Tehran to the meeting places of the Muslim Brotherhood and its affiliated organizations here in America, Islamism is on the march. Under the pernicious influence of radicals who seek to impose Islamic law on the world, barbaric practices that Islam sanctioned in the 7th century, killing apostates, stoning women, and hanging homosexuals, are spreading. Islam is increasingly becoming intolerant, not just of Westerners and others around the world who seek to stand up for basic freedoms and human rights, but of millions of Muslims as well. These voices for moderation, for a classically liberal approach that recognizes faith as something between God and an individual, not to be imposed by governments, are being silenced and in some instances targeted and killed. That is the problem. A reformation within Islam is urgently needed, and yet it may be as far away as it ever has been. Had followers of Islam worked to systematically reform it, dissociating themselves from the barbaric ways of the past, we would not find ourselves in a place where the religion itself is at the center of the debate, and unfortunately, of so much terror and death around the world. Instead, we are left with a religion that professes to be good and peaceful, but that counts among its faithful millions of followers who are anything but. How can those things be reconciled? Are we to believe that terrorists and Islamists, people who are the strictest followers of their faith, are reading the Quran and the Hadith entirely wrong? If that sounds as absurd to you as it does to me, then it's time to take a closer look at what these main texts of the faith really say and why so many have found in them justification for hatred and violence. Lie number one. Islam is a religion of peace, and Islamic terrorists aren't really Muslims. Islam is a religion that preaches peace, President Barack Obama. I stopped calling these people Muslim terrorists. They're about as Muslim as I am. I mean, they have no respect for anybody else's life. That's not what the Quran says. Howard Dean, former Democratic Party chairman on MSNBC. For decades, Americans have been told that Islam is a religion of peace. This is an endless refrain repeated by presidents and prime ministers, media figures and sports stars, the Pope, and even terrorists themselves. In the days after the 9/11 attacks, the Bush White House went to great pains to stress that the United States was not at war with all people of the Islamic faith. The administration assumed incorrectly that Islam is not much different than the host of other religions that differ from Christianity. They wanted to believe that Islam preaches peace, so they decided that it did. On September 17th, 6 days after the World Trade Center was toppled and the Pentagon smoldered, President George W. Bush went to an Islamic center in Washington, D.C., and sought to distance Islam from the attacks. These acts of violence against innocents violate the fundamental tenets of the Islamic faith, Bush said. And it's important for my fellow Americans to understand that that is not what Islam is all about. Islam is peace. Former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice also noted the benevolence that is at the heart of Islam. The Obama administration has continued this theme and taken it to torturous extremes. Under questioning from Congress, then-Attorney General Eric Holder spent 2 straight minutes refusing to say the word Islam in conjunction with terrorism. "I don't want to say anything negative about a religion," Holder explained in his testimony. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has also been overly politically correct, noting that most Muslims are peaceful and tolerant people, and attacking those who have distorted the Islamic faith. Sometimes telling a lie often enough gets people to believe it. A 2009 poll conducted by the Washington Post and ABC News indicated that 58% of Americans believe that Islam is a peaceful religion. There's been a shift in those numbers recently, thanks in part to the unraveling of the Middle East and the rise of the Islamic State, but not a huge one. A 2015 Rasmussen poll found that 52% of Americans now believe that Islam encourages violence to a greater degree than other religions. That still leaves 48% of Americans, nearly half the country, who have bought into the idea that Islam itself really is the religion of peace that its apologists claim. These apologists justify their claim in several ways. First, they discuss the word Islam itself, asserting that Islam actually translates to peace because in Arabic it is based on the same root word, salam. That word, salam, can be found in the traditional greeting, assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you. But as Middle East scholar Daniel Pipes explains, the word Islam more accurately translates to submission. There is no connection in meaning between salam and Islam, peace and submission, he writes. These are 2 distinct words with unrelated meanings. In brief, Islam equals submission. The notorious British Islamic preacher Anjem Chowdhury, a vocal supporter of the Islamic State and a co-founder of the terrorist group Al-Muhajirun, agrees with this analysis. In an op-ed piece justifying the attack by Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists on the magazine Charlie Hebdo, which killed 12 journalists and a Paris policeman, Chowdhury wrote, "Contrary to popular misconception, Islam does not mean peace, but rather means submission to the commands of Allah alone. Therefore, Muslims do not believe in the concept of freedom of expression, as their speech and actions are determined by divine revelation and not based on people's desires." But even this is not enough for apologists of radical Islam. Those who cling to the religion of peace dogma argue that submission itself is a sign of peaceful intention. Submitting to the will of Allah is a personal choice made by every Muslim to help them find peace and tranquility. After all, they claim many Christians speak about surrendering to God's will. An academic project called Muslim Voices at the University of Indiana notes that in Christianity, surrendering to God is a way of putting your life into more capable hands. In fact, Jesus asked many of his disciples to surrender their livelihoods and follow him. In addition to debating word origins and meaning, advocates of Islam is peace cite the highest authority possible, the Quran. Take, for example, President Obama's 2009 Cairo speech. "The Holy Quran," Obama said, "teaches that whoever kills an innocent, it is as if he has killed all mankind. And whoever saves a person, it is as if he has saved all mankind." If this were in fact the sum of what the Quran says on this topic, then President Obama would have a strong case. But it's not. Obama, like many others, is misquoting the verse found in Surah 5:32. Here is the actual translation. "Because of that we ordained for the children of Israel, that if anyone killed a person not in retaliation of murder or and to spread mischief in the land, it would be as if he killed all mankind, and if anyone saved a life, it would be as if he saved the life of all mankind. And indeed, there came to them our messengers with clear proofs, evidences, and signs, even then after that many of them continued to exceed the limits, e.g. by doing oppression unjustly and exceeding beyond the limits set by Allah by committing the major sins in the land." And then note what comes in the very next verse, Surah 5:33. "The recompense of those who wage war against Allah and His Messenger and do mischief in the land is only that they shall be killed or crucified, or their hands and their feet be cut off on the opposite sides, or be exiled from the land. That is their disgrace in this world, and a great torment is theirs in the hereafter." This is a significant change in tone. Crucial to unlocking the verse's meaning is an understanding of what it means to wage war or do mischief. One clue is found in the writings of medieval Islamic scholar Ibn Kathir. "Wage war" mentioned here means oppose and contradict, and it includes disbelief, blocking roads and spreading fear in the fairways. "Mischief in the land" refers to various types of evil. In other words, the Quran states that those who do not follow the tenets of Islam, that is, express disbelief, are waging war against the religion itself. Under the Quran, disbelief alone is enough to justify crucifixion and murder. Those who do not submit to Islam are at war with God Himself. This understanding is further clarified elsewhere in the Quran. Here is a quote from Surah 9:29. "Fight against those who, 1, believe not in Allah, 2, nor in the last day, 3, nor forbid that which has been forbidden by Allah and His Messenger, 4, and those who acknowledge not the religion of truth, i.e. Islam, among the people of the Scripture, Jews and Christians, until they pay the jizya with willing submission and feel themselves subdued." The implications are clear. Failing to submit to Islam puts you at war with God and true believers, and those believers are instructed to fight you until you submit. In that sense, perhaps Islam could indeed be called a religion of peace, with peace coming only through submission. Other evidence from Islam's foundational texts further supports the use of violence in the name of God. The Quran, for instance, reminds Muslims that they are expected to fight even if they might rather not. "Jihad, holy fighting in Allah's cause, is ordained for you Muslims, though you dislike it, and it may be that you dislike a thing which is good for you and that you like a thing which is bad for you. Allah knows, but you do not know. Quran 2:216. The Quran also explains the goal of this fighting, the spread of Islam. Say to those who have disbelieved, if they cease from disbelief, their past will be forgiven. But if they return thereto, then the examples of those punished before them have already proceeded as a warning. Quran 8:38. And fight them until there is no more fitna, disbelief, and polytheism, i.e. worshipping others besides Allah, and the religion, worship, will all be for Allah alone, in the whole of the world. But if they cease worshipping others besides Allah, then certainly Allah is all-seer of what they do. Quran 8:39. Muslims are allowed, even commanded, to fight until they achieve universal Islamic worship. This directive is further backed up by the hadith. The Messenger of Allah said, I have been commanded to fight against people so long as they do not declare that there is no God but Allah. Sahih Muslim 130. A subsequent verse in the hadith gets even more specific about the commands Muhammad received from Allah. The Messenger of Allah said, I have been commanded to fight against people till they testify that there is no God but Allah, that Muhammad is the Messenger of Allah, and they establish prayer and pay zakat. Sahih Muslim 133. Other Quranic passages have been specifically used to justify violence by those committed to carrying it out. Osama bin Laden himself opened a 2002 letter to the American people by quoting these verses. Permission to fight is given to those, i.e. believers against disbelievers, who are fighting them, and because they, believers, have been wronged, and surely Allah is able to give them, believers, victory. Quran 22:39. Those who believe fight in the cause of Allah, and those who disbelieve fight in the cause of Taghut, Satan, etc. So fight you against the friends of Shaitan, Satan. Ever feeble indeed is the plot of Shaitan, Satan. Quran 4:76. In fact, bin Laden was almost certainly aware that the Quran approves of the specific use of terror, and thus terrorism, by commanding that Allah's warriors strike terror into their foes. And make ready against them all you can of power, including steeds of war, tanks, planes, missiles, artillery, etc., to strike terror into the enemies of Allah and your enemy, and others besides whom you may not know but whom Allah does know. And whatever you shall spend in the cause of Allah shall be repaid unto you, and you shall not be treated unjustly. Quran 8:60. This too is supported in the hadith. Allah's apostle said, I have been sent with the shortest expressions bearing the widest meanings, and I have been made victorious with terror. Sahih al-Bukhari, Book 4, Volume 52, Hadith 220. In the real world, we are confronted constantly by the work of those who believe Allah will be made victorious with terror. Ayan Hirsi Ali, an acclaimed Somali-born women's rights activist and author, has warned the world about Islam for more than a decade. For more than 13 years now, I have been making a simple argument in response to such acts of terrorism, she writes. My argument is that it is foolish to insist, as our leaders habitually do, that the violent acts of radical Islamists can be divorced from the religious ideals that inspire them. Instead, we must acknowledge that they are driven by a political ideology, an ideology embedded in Islam itself, in the holy book of the Quran as well as the life and teachings of the Prophet Muhammad contained in the Hadith. In case anyone missed what she was saying, she added for emphasis, Let me make my point in the simplest possible terms. Islam is not a religion of peace. But you need not take this just from me, or from courageous speakers like Ayan Hirsi Ali. The leader of ISIS has said the exact same thing. A May 2015 recording, reported to be from ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, opens with his recitation of several verses straight from the Quran. The very first is another translation of verse 2:216. Fighting has been enjoined upon you while it is hateful to you. Al-Baghdadi continues, And he, the mighty and majestic, said, So let those fight in the cause of Allah, who sell the life of this world for the hereafter. And he who fights in the cause of Allah and is killed or achieves victory, we will bestow upon him a great reward. Quran 4:74. And he, the glorified, said, And those who are killed in the cause of Allah, never will he waste their deeds. He will guide them and amend their condition and admit them to paradise, which he has made known to them. Quran 47:4-6. Later he provided his own blunt commentary. O Muslims, Islam was never for a day the religion of peace. Islam is the religion of war. Next time you hear the never-ending platitudes about Islam being a religion of peace, don't cite my words as evidence to the contrary. Go directly to the source. Pick up a Quran and find any of the dozen surahs quoted in this chapter. Or read the words of our enemies. As Baghdadi put it plainly to each and every one of us, Islam is the religion of war. Lie number two. Islam is not much different than Christianity or Judaism. There is nothing in the Islam that is more violent than Christianity. All religions have been violent, including Christianity. Karen Armstrong, religion writer and former nun. Remember that during the Crusades and the Inquisition, people committed terrible deeds in the name of Christ. Barack Obama. Time and again in some bizarre attempts at moral equivalence, we've heard the comparisons of Islam and Christianity. Those who kill today in the name of Islam, we're told, aren't that different from those who killed in the name of Christ. After all, they claim the Bible contains passages that seem to condone violence or slavery. Philip Jenkins, a scholar of history and religion at Baylor University and Pennsylvania State University, claims that the Islamic scriptures in the Quran were actually far less bloody and less violent than those in the Bible. Sajjad Rizvi of the University of Exeter has tried to equate Islam and the Judeo-Christian tradition. Almost all the prophets of the Quran will be familiar to those who know the Bible, he says, and the Quran explicitly refers to parables, ideas, and stories from the Bible. The common roots and inheritances of the three faiths make it useful for us to think seriously in terms of a Judeo-Christian Islamic civilization and heritage that we all share. Karen Armstrong, a former nun and religion writer, argues that terrorism has nothing to do with Muhammad any more than the Crusades had anything to do with Jesus. Proponents of the hand-holding drum circle view of the world religions often point to the common origin of the three monotheistic faiths, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. This does have a basis in fact, as they can each be traced back to Abraham, who is viewed by all three faiths as a great prophet and, to varying degrees, as a literal or figurative father of the religion. In Judaism, he is the patriarch of the ancient Israelites, and therefore the Jews of today. Christianity grew out of Judaism, and the book of Matthew in the Bible explains that Abraham was an ancestor of Joseph, whose wife, Mary, gave birth to Jesus Christ. Muslims also revere Abraham as a significant prophet. According to Muslims, Muhammad himself is descended from Abraham as well. The Bible, particularly the Old Testament, contains stories of wars and battles and brutality that were everyday reality in the ancient world. In one passage in Leviticus, for instance, God commands Moses to take a blasphemer outside the camp, after which the entire assembly is to stone him. But that was centuries ago. Hebraic law does not command the murder of blasphemers and adulterers. Jews don't routinely resort to practices that date to the time of Moses and David. For Christians, Jesus Christ brought an entirely different understanding of the relationship between his followers and the state. Christ told his disciples, My kingdom is not of this world, and that they should give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. In the first centuries, Christians were an embattled minority that fought against the empires that persecuted them. Only 300 years after the time of Christ did Christianity become associated with temporal or worldly authority with its adoption as the official religion of the Roman Empire. A millennium later, Christianity underwent a reformation that adopted the modern idea of a permanent separation between the church and state. Islam, by contrast, hasn't reformed at all. The vast majority of Muslims since the time of Muhammad have seen their faith as a holistic, all-encompassing way of life, inseparable from politics and law. All authority in the Islamic faith flows from God. There is no separation of church and state in the Sunni Islamic tradition. The caliph was a religious and political leader in one. Robert Spencer, director of the Jihad Watch program at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, explains that Islam has always had a political and social character, including a full program for government. This program for government comes in the form of Islamic law, Sharia, a series of rules and prescriptions derived from the Quran and other sources of the teachings of Muhammad, such as the Hadith. Unlike the Jews fleeing Egypt for the promised land of Israel, and unlike Christians escaping martyrdom and the persecution of the Roman Empire, Islam has been a political force from its start, when Muhammad gathered his followers and moved them to Medina from his original hometown of Mecca. This event was so significant that it marks the beginning of time for the faith. The Islamic calendar does not begin at Muhammad's birth or death, nor when he first received visions of Allah, but at the date of this move to Medina, where Muhammad became a political and military leader and Islam became a state. Spencer points out that to this day, Islam assumes that its faith must be the ruling ideology of the state. The capacity for willful ignorance among members of the political and media elite when it comes to the realities of radical Islam never ceases to amaze. They ignore, for instance, the inherently political goals of Islam, such as the desire to impose Islamic Sharia law as the law of the land and to resurrect the caliphate that will ensure its enforcement. Other religions make demands on their community of adherents. Islam, by contrast, demands submission before Islamic law for non-Muslims as well. The view that Sharia should be a ruling ideology enjoys broad support in the Muslim world today. We get into this a bit more later in the book, but what's relevant for this lie about the Islamic equivalency to other major religions is the fact that a vast number of Muslims around the world still support enforcing some of the harshest punishments found in Sharia law. These are known as hudud, and a 2013 Pew Research Center survey describes them as follows. A class of punishments prescribed by the Quran and the Sunnah, another source of Muhammad's teachings, for crimes considered to be against God. Although interpretations by Islamic jurists vary, such crimes commonly include theft, adultery, making unproven accusations of adultery, consuming intoxicants, armed robbery, and apostasy. The prescribed punishments range from lashes to banishment to death. Majorities of those Muslims who favored imposing Sharia law also supported hudud punishments for theft, which can include whippings or the cutting off of hands. Among the supporters of such barbaric practices, hudud punishments for theft, percentage supporting by country. Pakistan, 88%. Afghanistan, 81%. Palestinian territories, 76%. Egypt, 70%. Malaysia, 66%. Jordan, 57%. Iraq, 56%. And what about women accused of adultery? A majority of Muslims who support the imposition of Sharia law in several countries believe those women should be stoned. Stoning for adultery. Pakistan, 89%. Afghanistan, 85%. Palestinian territories, 84%. Egypt, 81%. Jordan, 67%. Iraq, 58%. Tajikistan, 51%. Even in Russia, 26% of Muslims supporting Sharia law shared this view of adultery. You'll note that many of the countries on this list are those that have received billions of dollars in support from the United States government. In case anyone forgets, this Pew survey was published 13 years into the 21st century. Man has walked on the moon, cured devastating diseases, and invented ways to make information travel around the world instantly. But in the Muslim world, significant portions of the population still want to cut off thieves' hands, stone cheating spouses, and kill anyone who converts to another religion. It's not just the stereotypical countries that are home to Muslims with these extreme beliefs. The same sentiments have crept into unexpected places, like Norway. In November 2013, Fahad Qureshi, an Islamic leader in the Scandinavian nation, proclaimed to a large assembly of Sunni Muslims that Americans are being lied to. The Western media, Qureshi said, falsely claimed that only radicals and extremist Muslims support extreme Hudud punishments for violators of Sharia. "Every Muslim believes in these things," said Qureshi. "Just because they are not telling you about it, or just because they are not out there in the media, doesn't mean that they don't believe in them." Qureshi asked the attendees of the assembly to raise their hands if they agreed that men and women should sit separate. Then he asked, "How many of you agree that the punishments described in the Quran